MSU Today is online at SpartanPodcast.com. Here's Russ White.
Here's Michigan State University President Luanna Simon and Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis with MSU Urban Agriculture Guru Mike Hamm.
Well, it's our pleasure to welcome Mike Hamm, MSU's C.S. Mott Professor of Sustainable Agriculture. And we want to talk a bit about this concept of urban farming, urban agriculture, both in Detroit, but also as it's evolving around the country and now the world. Mm-hmm. So for our listeners, what's the difference between urban agriculture, urban food systems, and urban gardening?
That's a very good question, and one that many people try to deal with the issues of what's on the head of a pin. For me, I think of urban agriculture as producing for the market. So it may be producing for a farmer's market, for a corner grocery store, for the school system, but it's producing for market. You're trying to generate an income from it. Community garden is generally producing for yourself, for your home, for your family, for your friends, but it's not part of the market economy. That's how I distinguish them.
And then within agriculture, there's sort of production agriculture and food, and then there's food processing, food systems.
That's
that
right.
Include sort of delivery and of food. So as you think about the urban environment, how are those issues going to have to fit together?
Right. So it's an issue across America and across the world, actually, of how do we feed people in urban places? And in a place like Detroit, where we now have about 750,000 people, and the question becomes, how do all those people get a healthy diet on a daily basis? So urban agriculture is poised actually to play a significant role, especially with people being able to access fresh fruits and vegetables. So community gardens in Detroit, for example, have expanded to now where there's something like 2,000 community gardens spread across the city of Detroit. So there's thousands of people that are producing small amounts of food for themselves. And then we get to urban agriculture, where people are looking at anywhere from 1 to 100-acre farms inside the city of Detroit to produce fruits and vegetables and other kinds of crops for people to consume. Now, those crops have to get to market, so there needs to be a distribution infrastructure. So you've got places like Eastern Market in Detroit that are working at becoming a food hub for the residents of Detroit, which means that that's a place where that food that's grown can come in, and then buyers come in and get it and take it to corner grocery stores, to mobile markets, to the schools for the school lunch program, so that food can get out. Now, we also have, of course, we're challenged from a seasonal standpoint in terms of production. We typically don't produce fruits and vegetables year-round. So what does that mean? If we're going to get them from local sources, we've either got to figure out a way to extend the growing season, which we can do with technology developed here at MSU and elsewhere, or we can think about processing that. And so now there's things like individual quick frozen IQF processes where you can freeze fruits and vegetables and maintain the nutritional value very, very heavily. And use those for other parts of the year. So that needs to be put into the mix. Right now, we do not have that kind of processing here in Michigan. It gets shipped down to Indiana and Ohio for that kind of processing. So we can think about adding that into the urban area, again, as a job creator and as a way to expand food access in the urban areas. The other piece of it that I think is we need to keep track of is that that's only one part of the food supply that people in Detroit need. They also need animal products. Most people are not vegetarians. They want animal products. They need grains. They need dry beans. They need other kinds of things, most of which are not going to be grown in the urban area. So that's where there's opportunities for partnerships between the farms in the rural parts of Michigan and the populations in the urban centers. And so, again, places like Eastern Market and grocery store distributors and other kinds of places become opportunities to aggregate that food produced in the rural areas. In the case of dairy, for example, where we're probably not going to have dairy farms in Detroit, but we have lots of dairy farms in Michigan. We have a lot of people that would like to produce milk and cheese products and various things. So, again, we have processors that process that, put it into usable form, get it into the marketplace in Detroit through various outlets. So these rural urban, beyond urban agriculture, the rural urban partnerships to make use of the rural products that are grown, build the economy of the rural areas at the same time that we're getting good food into the urban areas is another opportunity for Michigan.
I believe one of the things I read was there's limited or no supermarkets in the city limits down in Detroit. So when you talk about the distribution system, you know, I think that's something I'd like to hear a little bit about on the growth of that. And then secondarily, the growth on the non-traditional farmer or the farmer of the future and, right. and what that workforce is going to look like, how you go about generating that workforce for the future.
Sure. Let me take the first one, which is how do we get that food out to people? Because there aren't any supermarkets in Detroit. And we've had an explosion of one arena of distribution in Michigan in the last 8 years, which is my time in Michigan. We've gone from about 90 to 240 farmers markets across the state. There's been a growth. It used to be that there was just the Eastern Market in Detroit, and now there's a half a dozen or more farmers markets inside Detroit. It used to be that people that were on SNAP benefits or food stamps could not use those at farmers markets. This summer, we'll have 70 farmers markets across the state of Michigan that accept SNAP benefits, where people can use their food stamps to purchase mm-hmm. fresh food. So that's one thing, is for at least about a six-month period of the year, we can actually markedly expand the distribution of these products through these direct market outlets and get a high dollar value to the farmer. The other thing that's going on in Detroit, and this is through our colleagues at Wayne State University and Kami Patakuchi and other people there, is working with some of the corner grocery stores in the city to help them develop the tools, the strategies, and the floor space to carry better fresh produce, higher quality foods, and get those out to people in the city. And then through the Detroit Economic Growth Corporation, there is an initiative there to try to get some supermarkets sited in the city as well. That's going to take longer term. Mm-hmm. So the way that I look at it is let's triage it. Let's look at those things that we can do right now, i.e. direct market opportunities and corner grocery stores. And then secondarily, let's look at those things that are going to take maybe a 3, 5, 6 year window to make happen, and that would be supermarkets in the city.
I grew up in Lexington, which is north of Port Huron, and very agricultural area. Sugar beets. We had everything up there. And talk to me why would we go into a city to create this agricultural vehicle when around the city there are so many acres of land that are being used for this purpose?
Sure. And that probably gets to this issue of who are going to be the new farmers of tomorrow too. And my contention is that we actually need to do both. So let me go national for a second. If we look nationally at our dietary patterns, so we've got 300 million Americans or so in the United States who eat about half the amount of fresh fruits and vegetables they should. Now, certainly, I've got a 12-year-old daughter who plays soccer, and one of the daunting tasks is trying to get her to eat right to be able to play soccer for 60 minutes without a break. And it continues to be a daunting task because she turned 13 yesterday.
I have a 12-year-old son. If it's not in a wrapper, he's not eating it. So.
That's exactly. Yeah. So we, you know from which I speak.
Exactly.
So we eat about half of what we should. Now, if we put that in perspective of production, that's about 14 million acres of fruit and vegetable production, which is 2 to 3 Californias of production, where half of our domestic production occurs. The point of that is that we need to massively expand production across the country while at the same time we're massively expanding demand. I think we can do demand side. I think we can do the production side. The trick is how do we then get the two together? So that's part one. Point number two is that what that would mean in Michigan is probably somewhere on the order of 300,000 to 400,000 more acres of production of fruits and vegetables in terms of kind of our fair share versus compared to our population. That's land that can come in rural areas. It's land that can come in urban areas. In a place like Detroit, we've probably got about 10,000 acres of land in Detroit that could be put into production agriculture that right now is vacant land and it's abandoned, in essence. In Flint, we've probably got about 400 or 500 acres of land that could be put into production agriculture. The point with urban agriculture is not that to displace the rural production, not to do it in place of the rural production, to recognize that we need both, but also to recognize that that urban space, while it's being put into production agriculture, is also serving other useful values for the city and for the residents of Detroit. It's doing something with open space that otherwise is used as dumping grounds oftentimes. It's turning that into green space where people can start to enjoy a nice site instead of a blighted site. And in many cases, it's giving people a sense of empowerment in the city in terms of what they can do with their land. And so in one ways, urban agriculture is an important tool for greening the cities as some of these cities depopulate. Mm-hmm. But again, it's not at the expense of the rural areas. And in fact, if anything, I'd say that we need to simultaneously build up both.
You're tuned to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. MSU President Luanna Simon and Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis are talking about urban agriculture with Mike Hamm from Michigan State University's CS Mott Group for Sustainable Food Systems. There's more online at mottgroup.msu.edu.
Not all urban agriculture occurs on land. There's plans for using abandoned buildings, mm-hmm. other kinds of things. I guess vertical agriculture is the phrase of the moment. So talk about how this also helps with cities and other activities.
Sure. Well, one of the things, let me start out by saying that I think there's a place for vertical agriculture, and I think the place for it is exactly what's being considered in places like Detroit, which is abandoned buildings, anywhere from 2 to 6 story, abandoned former manufacturing buildings, where the steel and concrete is already in place, and it's probably a relatively low cost and efficient redevelopment use of that building. Basically, all you got to do probably is put in some electric, some water, and put some double pane plastic on the windows. There's all kinds of plans out there worldwide for building new skyscrapers for vertical agriculture. From a standpoint of carbon footprinting and environmental sustainability, I can't believe that ever carbon footprints. But having the building already there and abandoned, I think, is a perfect reuse of that. And I think the other part of it is, I know that the things that are being considered are things like aeroponics and hydroponics, which is basically very low water usage, mostly contained atmospheres if you're going to do any kind of spraying or anything like that. So the odds of any kind of environmental impact in the surrounding community are, in fact, very minimal. And what little there is can be controlled very, very readily. So I actually think for things like greens production and some other kinds of things, that makes a huge amount of sense. And probably for winter production of tomatoes and things like that, I think a lot of this makes a lot of sense, and we ought to do it.
With all your work in New Jersey, is there an example there that people can look to from a positive standpoint of any application in the state of Michigan? Is there research that you'd point somebody toward, or do you think the work that we're doing in Michigan has already surpassed?
Well, that's only a little bit of a loaded question. Actually, I think right now—
Always remember who signs your check today.
Well, I tell my colleagues around the country that 8.5 years ago when I came to Michigan State, it was the best decision I made, because we're in the middle of the Midwest. We have the second most diverse agriculture in the country. We've got these population centers of Detroit inside the state and that little place called Chicago just mm-hmm. outside the state. And so from a standpoint of all the things that can be done to build sustainable food systems in a way that makes sense and really enables a future for our state, this is the place to be. And if you look at the research that we've done here at MSU, you look at what John Birnbaum's done on high tunnel production and year-round production and the work he's doing with the dining halls now and the student farms doing with the dining halls. You look at the work that some of the faculty in crop and soil science are doing at soil remediation and some of the other things that are going on at this campus. And then what some of the nonprofit groups are doing in Detroit and Flint and Grand Rapids and some of these other places and up in Traverse City. We actually have at least as much going on as anywhere in the country. And in many places, in most places, is the place that people are turning to see what we're doing. Mm-hmm. So right now, actually, I think it's safe to say that Michigan is the place, and the work at Michigan State across all these different departments and faculty and staff, and the work across the state that's going on, the support that we have right now from state government, from some local government entities, with Senator Stabenow sitting there as the chair of the Senate Ag Committee, and the power that that gives to Michigan for the opportunity to do things. We are the place to be right now for this. We are the place to be.
One of the other, in reading some of your work, one of the other comments I saw that I really appreciated was you came out with a statement that as we look for economic recovery in the state, this is part of the solution, not all of the solution.
That's right.
And I think, that's a great perspective. Your alma mater just won its 3rd out of 4 lacrosse, women's lacrosse championships. And that's my wheelhouse is sports. We have 25 here at Michigan State. when you talk about nutritional value, and I know you got your undergrad in biology and your PhD in nutrition. So if you take those two and you look at it from the perspective of an athletic director, am I supposed to be feeding these kids different things depending on the sport that they come from?
I have to say, I'm not a sports nutritionist, so if anyone out there is listening that is, I might get myself in
big
trouble.
You are today.
But I'm a firm believer of that a healthy diet, by and large, will take care of just about anything. I mean, in track, we don't have marathoners. We don't run that distance. I think most sports, somebody eating a well-balanced diet and getting plenty of fruits and vegetables, getting the whole grains that they want to. I mean, I think it starts with basically the dietary recommendations of our U.S. public health agencies. And then for some sports like football, obviously they're burning tremendous amounts of calories, and many of these athletes are burning tremendous amounts of calories. And so getting these in the forms of complex carbohydrates and plenty of protein and all that is certainly essential. But I think it starts with basically making sure that they're eating that balanced diet that is recommended for all of us, and then putting the extra things on top that they need as an athlete who's doing hours and hours of physical activity, basically.
Mm-hmm. I'd like for you to for our listeners, lots of discussion about the population of the planet moving forward and the pressures we're going to have to produce enough food for not simply ourselves, but all the issues in the planet, and do that with a lower energy footprint. All that. And so would you mind just sort of describing that world problem and why then, going back to our beginning, why this the stuff that we're doing in Detroit and Flint is really so important, not simply for today, but in this global set of issues in the future?
I'd love to. So we're going to be adding about another 2.5 billion people to the world over the next 30, 40 years. That 2.5 billion people is going to need about 3.2 to 3.4 trillion pounds of food a year beyond what we're doing right now. That's a lot of food by any definition. The United States is going to add 100 million people to the world, which adds a need for about 120 to 140 billion pounds of food extra for the United States. We're going to have to do that in a world where there's going to be less fresh water. And more people requiring that fresh water. We're going to have to do that in a world where we're going to have more demands on energy, so it's going to have to be done with more energy. It's going to have to be done with less external inputs like nitrogen and phosphorus and potassium than we have right now. And it's probably going to have to be done on less land. Right now, California produces half of our domestic fruits and vegetables. They're slated to increase their population by 14 million people and may lose 70% of the snowpack runoff because of climate change scenarios for the Sierra Nevadas. You take that all into account, and California is not going to be doing in 20 or 30 years what it's doing now, probably. And so we have an opportunity in a place like Michigan with lots of water and lots of land, if we preserve those natural resources, if we, A, don't sell off the Great Lakes, and if we, B, maintain the farmland that we have and don't develop all the good farmland as the economy recovers. If we do all that, we can think about being the place to be in 20 or 30 years with respect to agriculture and probably with respect to a livable place to be. So what that all means is that we're going to be feeding 2.5 billion more people, which means that that urban agriculture in Detroit becomes more important because it's about spatialization. That rural agriculture and preserving the skills and talents that we have now for producing those 200 different crops and animals is as important as preserving the land base and is as important as preserving the water base that we have. All of that means that we have a responsibility right now to, in fact, preserve and enhance our human talent and our natural resources now so that those 2.5 billion people down the road can eat. I think the last thing we want to do, you've got a 12-year-old son, I've got a daughter who just turned 13 yesterday, so they're basically the same age. 40 or 50 years, the last thing we want to have to say to them is, sorry. Mm-hmm. I want my daughter to be able to have all the same opportunities in this world that I've had. I want all of those kids in Detroit to be able to have all the same opportunities in this world that I have. That means, and I think about it from a standpoint of food, that means that they have to have an access to a healthy diet so they can live and learn while they're in school now, so that they can be active, and so that when they get to adulthood, they have the skills and the talent and the opportunity to move forward and to help us move forward.
And apart from that, if you don't want to sort of resonate to the humanitarian or set of issues, it really is a national security issue as well. So those people who want to sort of see some of the work we're doing in urban settings as part of our do-gooder part of the university, and I think both you and I see it as job creation, as to creating this more sustainable world with, but also it is a national security issue. And I want to have you comment on that.
I would love to, because actually Senator Roberts this morning, we agreed totally, because one of his comments was, show me a country that can't provide its own food supply and I'll show you a country in decline. And I think that's absolutely true. And I think part of the work that we're doing on regional food systems and local food systems, I look at it as relocalizing and re-regionalizing our food system, having more diverse points of production for all kinds of crops and products that we're going to eat and consume in the marketplace, is in fact a key way to ensure our national security, because what we've done is we've reduced the supply point pressure on single points. And I use right now the earthquake in Japan as a classic metaphor for what we face down the road with food if we're not careful. If you look at the consumer electronics industry and some of the auto manufacturers after that earthquake and the subsequent tsunami, they were in deep trouble because their points for microchips was one place, right there. And they were in danger. And now they're rethinking. My conversations with David Close over in the School of Business is that they're starting to rethink their supply chains and how to diversify their points of supply. And I think that's a big part of this whole movement around regional food systems, is rethinking the way that we're producing, processing, and distributing food in this country so that we make ourselves more resilient as we move down the road for our country's future. And that is exactly the point of national security around food.
I think the work you're doing is amazing and critical. I think those are two adjectives that I would give that. My only question is, how do we stop our 12-year-olds from only relying on food that they have to rip the package open on? That's it is important. It's important that we educate not only ourselves, but I think those that follow us.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it very much, Mike.
Well, thank you for having me, and thank you for all your support.
That was MSU President Luanna Simon and Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis with Mike Hamm from MSU's CS Mott Group for Sustainable Food Systems. To hear that conversation again, please visit SpartanPodcast.com.
Hi, it's Scott Westerman for the Michigan State University Alumni Association. And if you're the parent of a Spartan, there's no better gift you can give than a lifetime membership in the largest Spartan organization in the world. Joining the MSUAA family opens the doors to our network of over 500,000 Spartans who'll help you feel right at home wherever you go, who can help connect you with Spartans on the inside, who can help you grow in your career. People who give you special treatment just because you're a Spartan. And an investment in a life membership in the MSU Alumni Association doesn't just add value to your Spartan life. It helps Spartans everywhere build more competitive skill sets and move more quickly in the direction of their dreams. Learn more about an MSUAA life membership online at alumni.msu.edu. That's alumni.msu.edu. The Michigan State University Alumni Association. Your personal network for life.
This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's your host, Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, it's a pleasure to welcome back to the program Jim Byram. Jim's president of the Michigan Agribusiness Association, which is headquartered in Lansing, Michigan, recently announced the second year of a green agribusiness designation program. We're going to learn all about that, Jim. Good to have you back on the show.
It's always a pleasure, Kirk.
The green agribusiness designation program, you're looking for applications for 2012. Talk about the origins of the program, the success you had in your first year. Why are you doing it?
Well, it's really a great story. We had several members that said, look, we do a lot of things that really are environmentally sound and sensitive, and we do a lot of things that are right, and we don't get a lot of credit for it. A lot of folks realize that we spread a lot of fertilizer, we apply pesticides, we use genetically enhanced seed, we do a lot of different things, and we run great big equipment. But there's a lot of things that we do today that are much different than they were 10 years ago or 15 years ago, and we thought it would be good to highlight some of the really good things that agribusiness does and agriculture in general does, and that's what the purpose of the program was, that's what the genesis was. Last year we had 34 designees, and this year we anticipate we'll top well over 50, probably closer to 60. And it's just a good opportunity for agribusiness to tout what they do and how they really are environmentally sensitive.
Before we talk about some of those agribusinesses that have applied and have been designated as green, when your association is generally well known in agricultural circles, but for our listeners, who are your members and what is the Michigan Agribusiness Association?
Michigan Agribusiness Association, we used to say, is basically a group that represents everybody in agriculture in Michigan except farmers. Today, we have many, many farmers that also belong to our association. So we have feed mills, we have fertilizer dealers, we have grain handlers, we have those involved in renewable fuels like ethanol plants. We have all sorts of folks across the spectrum, those that apply and sell pesticides to control pests across the state. It's a wide spectrum of industry, and many of the large producers that now belong to our association also are those that are heavily engaged in food production and processing. So it's a wide range of membership across the state of Michigan. We have about 600 members today, and it continues to grow every year.
Well, let's talk about a couple of these that have this green agribusiness designation. You mentioned several of your members, and I notice these businesses are across the spectrum. You got feed mills, you got ethanol and biodiesel plants involved in green designation. Mm-hmm. How does somebody get green designated, and what does it mean?
Well, the first thing they do is highlight and tell us about some of the things that they've done, and let's talk about some of the practices. Applying fertilizer used to be fill up the spreader, go out and spread it across the field. Today, fertilizer application is done based on a soil test result over a very small grid, we call them, in the field. Whereas it may be a field that's 40 acres, they'll pull a soil test from a small area, probably a half acre or so. They'll soil test every half acre across that 40-acre field, so they'll have 80 soil tests. Then we upload that information to a computer, and then the fertilizer applicator. We essentially apply nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium to the field. But as that applicator goes across the field now, it only applies what that particular half acre needs. That's done by this soil test result, of course, and then satellite download to the applicator that changes what's applied on the fly as that applicator grows across the field. The other thing that's interesting is that applicator today really isn't driven by a person. It's driven by satellite technology and auto steer, so we don't overlap. So we only apply the fertilizer that's necessary in that particular area. We don't overlap, so we apply less fertilizer actually per acre than we used to. We do it more judiciously and more appropriate for what the objective is, and we do it in such a fashion that we don't overlap. That's the kind of thing we do not just with fertilizer, but with pesticide application, with seed planting these days, with variable rate seed planting. The technology is a big piece of this whole environmentally driven program.
Jim, the examples you just used were agronomic examples, but part of your application allows for things like recycling and transportation efficiencies. What are some of these agribusinesses doing in recycling?
The basic kind of things we're doing in recycling, pesticide containers, for example, we recycle pesticide containers, we recycle pallets, we recycle paper packaging, we recycle all sorts of things that come with pallet wrapping, the plastic that wraps up pallets. There's all sorts of things like that that are recycling. And then in terms of the kind of things that we're doing in transportation, it's really cool. We actually have a couple members that are using water as their fuel source. Now, what that means is they're hydrogen driven. They're using hydrogen in test markets and test vehicles across the state. And we're not talking about cars and trucks here. We're talking about heavy haul trucks, very large pieces of equipment. So there's those kinds of things that are going on, and that's precisely why we created this program, to highlight some of those really unique and innovative kind of things that are going on all across the state.
Jim, one of the things that really jumped out at me, as you know, I don't need to tell you how big water is. I mean, globally, it's a huge issue. But your application allows for water conservation practices. A lot of folks in agriculture are really taking this water conservation seriously.
Water is a huge issue. I'll talk about one specific plant we have that's an ethanol plant that, when it was originally constructed, used to use several thousand gallons of water every day and then discharge several thousand gallons of water every day. Because of changes in their process, they certainly use water to make ethanol, but they discharge nothing. It's a self-contained closed-loop system. They use water to make ethanol and discharge no water anymore, whereas they used to discharge several thousand gallons every single day. Those are the kind of things we're talking about in water conservation that are really critical not just in processing, but also in livestock production as well.
Jim, we talked about recycling on the farm and farm businesses, agricultural businesses, transportation, some agronomics. One thing about facilities we haven't talked about, LEED certification has been big for quite a while. It sounds like it's getting big in agribusiness as well.
We're seeing all sorts of things going on out here in the countryside. You know, we're talking about renewable energy, and I like to say renewable energy is rural development, because if we're going to have rural renewable energy, rather, it's going to take some of the acreage, it's going to take some of the big facilities we have in the countryside. As we talk about the kind of things, the kind of buildings folks are building, we're going to start looking at using some solar shingles. We're going to talk about things like solar collectors on roofs of some of these big agricultural buildings across the state. We're going to talk about methane digesters. There's already some in place. There's going to be more. And we're going to talk about wind power. There's all sorts of opportunities out here in rural Michigan to look at the kinds of things we need to do to wean ourselves from foreign oil. And that's all about LEED certification, not just from being more environmentally sound with buildings that are constructed, but also being able to generate some of our own energy. In fact, one of our very large members constructed their brand new office building over in Zeeland, Michigan, that's a totally LEED certified building. So agriculture really wants to be at the forefront of the kind of things we can do to be more environmentally sensitive.
One question we ask a lot about these companies that have gone LEED certified, everything from auto dealers to marinas to what have you, it's expensive sometimes to go LEED certified, but what is the long-term payoff? I mean, the company you mentioned in Zeeland, are they going to end up making some money on this LEED certification, or are they doing it because it's the right thing to do?
Yes, is the answer, but even let me go beyond that. Certainly it's the right thing to do, but every one of our members that is employed a lot of these environmentally sound practices, buying more fuel-efficient vehicles, looking at site-specific agriculture, all those kinds of things they're doing, being more conservation-minded with water use. Every one of those practices, the irony is, not only is the right thing to do, but economically it makes sense from a business perspective. And that's what's really the story here that doesn't get told. It's not about being all about just environmental. It's about sound, solid business practices that make sense economically, but also are environmentally sensitive and sound. And that's what we're looking at here, and it's really a great story.
Well, and it is the Michigan Agri Business Association, first and foremost, a business.
Absolutely.
Always has been. Let's look at some of the alternative energies you talked about. We'll move a little bit beyond your green certification. The windmill farms that are going up like crazy up in Gratiot County around Breckenridge. You mentioned solar. You mentioned hydrogen. We're talking about natural gas, compressed gas in some fleet vehicles, all sorts of things. What is the energy portfolio in agriculture going to look like 5 to 10 years from now?
I think the most important thing we need to recognize, it's not a silver bullet. There's not one that's going to be all the answer, but there's areas where wind makes a whole lot of sense. In fact, it's really interesting to drive through Gratiot County at night now and see the tops of those windmills with all those marker lights on top of the towers synced. You wonder what kind of Martian vehicle is landing. But wind's going to be a piece of it in some areas. Methane digesters are going to be increasingly important, especially in large livestock operations, and those make a lot of sense, especially as they look at taking at least some of their operations off the grid, which is going to be interesting. Solar, we say a lot about solar, a lot of things happening there. That technology improves every day. Ethanol production, biodiesel production, all those kinds of fuels, all those kinds of energy sources are a piece of the equation to wean ourselves from foreign oil, and that's what's going to be really important. The other piece that we like to talk about is all these rural energy processes and production systems happen at what I call the end of the line. We're at the end of the grid, if you will, for all the major utilities in the state, and that's where a lot of growth is happening in this state, is in rural parts of the state. So we need that energy production out there to continue to grow. We've had members that have had to spend major money, $500,000 in one case I'm aware of, to run enough power to fuel or to drive their facility. Now, that's the kind of thing that we have to look at rural renewable energy sources to try to create some of that energy locally.
My guest is Jim Byram, president of the Michigan Agribusiness Association. We're talking about issues in agriculture that are related to sustainability. Jim, let's talk about the Farm Bill. That's a huge issue in Washington. And I know this is a tough call because we don't know where this thing is going. You probably have a better idea than most folks. But In terms of Conservation Reserve Program, which has been around for a long time, which has really been environmentally friendly, in terms of tax credits for biofuels, where are some of these things going? Is the new Farm Bill going to continue to push sustainability, or is it going to back off?
We've had a very strong position that Conservation Reserve as a program needs to continue. However, Class 1 farmland, good farmland that's productive, that's in that program, should probably be farmed. Environmentally sensitive land that's highly erodible or wetlands or whatever needs to stay in CRP. We fully support that. We anticipate there's going to be moves generally in that direction as a Farm Bill comes forward. In terms of biofuel emphasis, the president's been very clear. We've seen an awful lot of emphasis on biofuels and bioproducts we need to start talking about, as I know you do, Kirk, regularly. But a lot of those kinds of opportunities are going to receive emphasis and frankly should, because if we to coin a phrase that's been used a couple times, if we grow it here, we need to build it here or make it here. And that's the kind of things I think we'll see in the Farm Bill. Relative to the Farm Bill overall, we think we need to have a Farm Bill passed in 2011. We think it needs to, or 2012. It needs to happen today. We need to get it done because who knows what Congress is going to look like in the next cycle, and we get further and further away from the farm with every Congress we have. We need to get it passed, need to get it done now. We fully support Senator Stabenow efforts to get that done.
Yeah, and she is anxious to get that thing passed, I mean, as we both know. And she seems to have some bipartisan support from some of the legislators in the heartland.
It's interesting, after the budget meltdown that happened last year, where there was an agreement in the Deficit Reduction Committee, that a lot of people have suddenly realized that we do need to get a Farm Bill done. We need to get it done now. We need to protect those critical programs for agriculture, like crop insurance and risk management and conservation programs and biofuels. And we need to get it done before we see any more uncertainty relative to what happens inside the Beltway.
Agriculture has been a really good economic story for the most part for the last several years, when a lot of other things have been in the tank. One thing has been farmland values that have been going up. There has been some controversy surrounding costs of commodities, what have you, and farmland prices going up. There's been a lot of investment capital now that's flowing into farmland. Where do you see this farmland bubble going, and what impact might that have on some of the things we've talked about?
Well, and that's a question. Is it a bubble, farmland? I mean, I tend to believe that overall agriculturally, we have seen a shift in paradigm of pricing. We're not going to see dollar and a half or $2 corn again. We're not going to see $3 soybeans again. We're seeing a different paradigm of pricing in commodities, which is driven by demand. And I want to stress, that's not ethanol demand, it's world demand. 3 years ago, China was a major exporter of corn in the world market. Today, they're going to be our number one or number two customer for corn exported from the United States. As the world population grows, there's more hungry mouths out there, and we have to feed them. And as the world population shifts to more middle class, they want to eat like we do. They want to eat more pork and beef and poultry products and more eggs and more dairy products. And as that happens, we have to have more commodity production of corn and soybeans, specifically corn and soybeans. The irony is that we're producing more of those per acre every year as well. So what's going to happen? We're going to see shifts in prices, but I think we're at a different pricing paradigm with commodities and farmland as well. As I do like to say somewhat facetiously, the most dangerous place to be right now is between two farmers and a 40-acre piece of farmland for sale. Because if it's a neighbor piece of farmland, those are the stories you're hearing where prices go way out of bounds. But normal pricing of farmland is probably going to be pretty darn steady, we believe.
Well, a lot of good news about agriculture. I've been talking with Jim Byram, president of the Michigan Agribusiness Association. Jim, for those listening who might want to know more about your Green Agribusiness Designation Program, they can just go to the MABA website, and it's right there because I looked at it myself.
Absolutely. MyAgBiz.org, MyAgBiz.org is the general website address, and we welcome anyone to take a look at it. It's a great story in agriculture, great time to be in the business. And I also have to mention, Kirk, there's some really great occupations out here. Folks are looking at some science-based, high-tech opportunities for employment.
Absolutely. Jim, thanks so much for being on the show.
Always a pleasure.
That was Greening of the Great Lakes with Dr. Kirk Heinze on MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Find more online at greeningofthegreatlakes.com.
Visit us online at spartanpodcast.com.
And for more MSU Today, visit us on the web at msutoday.com.
Hi, it's Scott Westerman for the MSU Alumni Association. Join the MSUAA family, and you're instantly connected to our network of over 500,000 Spartans in every corner of the world. Whether it's community, connections, career growth, or class, that's what the MSU Alumni Association is all about. Join the world's largest Spartan Nation community at alumni.msu.edu. That's alumni.msu.edu. The MSU Alumni Association, your personal network for life.
This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's your host, Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, my next guest on Greening the Great Lakes needs no introduction. Award-winning host of the Paul W. Smith Show each morning on WJR, he is Paul W. Smith.
You know, I always thought that was probably the best name for the show, given that my name is Paul W. Smith. We kicked around a lot of names. That's the one we came up with.
Paul W., great to have you on Greening the Great Lakes.
Nice to be here with you, Kirk. And nice of you to have a show now, entering your fourth season. And doing such a great job on such an important topic that gets kicked around and politicized and misunderstood. And you cut through all of that and offer clarity on something that's extremely important for all of us.
You've been going to auto shows all over the world, but you have a special place in your heart for the North American International Auto Show.
Of course.
Recently concluded. Green cars. Where are we going with alternative vehicles with green cars? Hybrids. We hear all of these terms. Consumers can be a little bit confused. What's your sense of it, Paul?
Everybody's a little confused, including the car makers, because we went back to the 80s with compressed natural gas being the answer. By the way, we're coming back to that as being an answer. And for good reason. We have a lot of natural gas. We could keep all of that energy found in America, used in America, which means American companies, American jobs, et cetera, et cetera. We had electric vehicles years and years ago. Thomas Edison was working with Henry Ford on distilling soybeans and soybean oil. I mean, there have been lots of different ways to go at this. Part of it's been very expensive for the auto industry because whatever the latest greatest is, and then a lot of times people feel, especially in the last couple of years, that the government has unduly tried to influence companies to make cars that people weren't necessarily ready to buy. Now, look, I've been a big proponent of little cars for a very long time because I go to those international motor shows. First, Ford Motor Company made that possible. Now, Chrysler has taken over. We'll be on Chrysler stands and Lear stands and Continental and others that make it possible for us to go there. And way back when, I was saying, there are little cars here that we probably will never see in the United States as they are. But if somebody wanted to build a little car and not treat it as an entry level, meaning you don't have all the bells and whistles that we now demand on our vehicles. If somebody really spent time making it a great little car, fun to drive, luxurious inside, and safe, people will line up to buy those. And especially as the price of gas goes up, they'll take a serious look at them. So in the greening of the Great Lakes and what you do, Kirk, on your show, the word is invaluable. It makes it sound like it's not valuable, but it is invaluable.
Well,
because you are taking a look at all the different ways that we go at this. You and I are talking electric cars now, and you drove the Volt. Do you own a Volt?
I own a Volt.
You
yes.
own a Volt, and I have driven a Volt and thought it was a fabulous car, just not right for me yet. I think it's close. It's a fabulous car. The workmanship, it's a luxury car. It's fun to drive. I just need it to go a little further on the battery. It's just my hang up, and I didn't have the right plug-in. You need the right plug-in that DTE Energy will put in for you, I guess, or give you a refund or make it possible for you to do it inexpensively so that you have that, what is it, 240?
It's a 240, and several of the electric suppliers will reimburse you to put one of those in your garage.
And you really need one of those if you're going to do this right, because otherwise I just plugged it in the garage, and it takes a much longer period of time if you're jumping around, driving a lot of different places.
Absolutely.
To get it all juiced up. But you know what? There's still – we saw this, Kirk, overseas, again, going to these overseas shows, is diesel is so good over there. And we've got good companies that are making the diesel rail systems. I hate to start naming names because I'll forget someone. There's just a lot of American suppliers that provide the technology for fabulous diesel that's used in cars that when you go over there and drive them, there's none of the stuff that we always worried about diesel, the hesitation, the smell, the smoke, the whatever it was that gave us a bad, frankly, taste in our mouth, no pun intended. You can't even tell you're driving a diesel, and we kind of jumped over that in America. And I still think we're going to go back. I still think diesel is going to be an important fuel to bridge the gap to whatever the next great fuel is.
And we don't know exactly what that next great fuel is going to be.
That's part of the problem. It was natural gas. It was electricity. It was gas and electricity. It may be all these other things that we're talking about. And all of that represents huge money invested in research and development, and then sometimes forgotten about or wasted.
There was an article recently in the Wall Street Journal that says, you know, in terms of the Chevy Volt, let's get specific here, the biggest competition for the Volt these days might be right across the lot with the Chevy Cruze. Same technology, conventional car, 35 miles to the gallon, no battery, no hybrid, et cetera. But in terms of the price point, about $15,000 cheaper than a Chevy Volt.
No question about
it. What are the consumers looking for here? They're looking for high mileage, performance, et cetera, and they're going to go where the value is.
We can't ask people, as we have in the past, to buy something just because it's, quote-unquote, the right thing to do, or that it's, for that matter, even made in America, look for the union label, all those things. All that's all well and good, but we can't ask people to sacrifice quality, safety, convenience, fun, all of those things on behalf of someone else. You have to provide a vehicle that answers all the calls. And if you say, which one did you say?
Cruze.
If the Cruze answers the call better than the Volt at this time because of the lower cost on the sticker right from the beginning and fabulous gas mileage, 35 miles per gallon, you said, and depending on where gas prices are and all of that, you can't blame people for picking the Cruze. They should be allowed to pick the best product for the buck, the best bang for the buck, which is why I've always said, and I used to say this to Ron Gettelfinger, I still say it today, it's not look for the union label. It's look for the union label that proves it's the best car being made in the world because it's made in America by great union workers. That's the way that works.
That's the message. Paul W., you talk to the biggest leaders in the automotive industry, though. There's a lot of investment, a lot of resources have gone into these alternative vehicles. I mean, how much is at stake here, though, in terms of marketplace, price points, sales, et cetera? I mean, these companies are going to be dependent on these cars doing fairly well, it seems to me.
Well, everything is. How dependent are they? They're dependent on every one of those things that you just mentioned, and it's happening worldwide. It's not like just the American manufacturers are being, quote-unquote, forced into doing this. Whatever pressure there is from our government, there's pressure from other governments for the car company, specifically in this case, because that's what we're talking about, to find greener ways to operate. And it's extremely important. Now, should a car company bet the ranch on a vehicle that's not selling? No. Should they be pushed or forced to do that? Absolutely not. Car companies are in the best position to know what's selling. And whatever's selling, they're going to make more of and make better more of those vehicles. And that's the way it works. We've already seen what happens when companies just keep making cars or try to make a certain car that nobody really wants to try to please somebody else. That is a losing proposition.
Absolutely, every time. Paul, last question here, and that is put on your visionary hat for a minute and look 5 years down the road, 10 years down the road. What are the highways going to look like? What is the mix of vehicles that are going to be on those highways from your perspective?
5-10 years down the road, I don't think it's going to be a lot different, the mix. I think that the cars will be better than ever because they've been becoming better than ever through competition. And I'm amazed with the incredible technology that we find on our own big three vehicles and other cars built around the world. I think that the cars will be safer in that, the technology they have now that helps you understand if you're getting too close to a car, There was some technology Continental introduced to me where they said, go ahead, try to run into the back of this car. I couldn't run into the back of the car in front of me. I mean, and believe me, Kirk, I tried. and there's incredible technology that with your side view mirror, if you start to go over and it senses there's a car there that you can't see because the guy's driving in your blind spot. Come on, people. But the car sees and goes, either goes beep, 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 or I've even felt one where the steering wheel starts to kick back and you go, what in the world? So the technology means we'll have safer cars. I think we'll still be driving them 5 and 10 years from now, even though they can park themselves. And don't tell anyone, but I have to tell you, Kirk, I like driving my car and always want to.
I've been talking with Paul W. Smith, who needs no other introduction. Paul W., thanks so much for being on Greening the Great Lakes, and good luck with those vehicles.
Kirk, thank you very much for having me, and thanks for being on my show the other day when we were broadcasting, again, with all of this in mind at Schupan and Sons Incorporated there in Wixom. And congratulations to you for your start of your fourth season and the fact that Schupan has been with you from the beginning.
They have been, and they've been great partners, and you've been a great partner.
They're good
as well.
Business people. They make good investments.
They sure do. Thanks so much, Paul W.
Thank you, Kirk.
That was Greening of the Great Lakes with Dr. Kirk Heinze on MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Find more online at greeningofthegreatlakes.com. You're tuned to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
Hi, it's Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association. We've all heard the expression, it's all about who you know. And wherever you are on your career ladder, having a friend on the inside can make all the difference. When you join the MSU Alumni Association family, you're instantly connected to a 500,000 Spartans around the world, many of whom are key decision makers in just about every major enterprise. Whether you're looking for a way in or a way up, your MSU Alumni Association affiliation can help you link up with that MSU alum who'll always take your call just because you're a Spartan. Building your network right now before you need it is the best possible career insurance, and joining the MSU Alumni Association is the best possible way to get the most out of your Spartan life. Learn more online at alumni.msu.edu. That's alumni.msu.edu. The MSU Alumni Association, your personal network for life.
The Michigan State University Department of Radiology is a leader in MRI, imaging research, and patient care. From world-class research to state-of-the-art patient care, we're providing outstanding diagnostic imaging technology. We're also a leader in sports medicine, delivering quality care to athletes and sports participants of all ages. Visit us online at rad.msu.edu and see how we are boldly designing the future. Visit us online at SpartanPodcast.com.
Thank you for listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Please visit us online at SpartanPodcast.com and tune in every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock for MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.